today, the 26th of January, and you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105 with Matt Bentman, Ruth Reyes and Alan Alder.
This is our first programme of new items this year. We thought the food scene in Cambridge would get off to a slow start, but we couldn't have been more wrong.
There's an Argentinian steakhouse opening next week, and two new pubs opening soon.
And there's also a family-run Sicilian-style cafe opening in a month or so. We also have news about the incredible food festival called Eat Cambridge that's coming in March.
News too about Andrew Northrop's already legendary salt beef.
And to keep up the pace, we've found out what the future may hold by asking Clara Paul of Books for Cooks in Notting Hill about current food trends in the capital. But to give us all a sense of perspective, we also have local historian Becky Proctor to tell us something about Cambridge's food history.
A little later in the programme, the wine critic Tom Lewis will be along to recommend some Valentine's Day drinks. There's a competition prize to win at 12:30, and we'll finish off with a review of the food and drink-related items in today's Quality Press.
Now, when Food Writer of the Year Tim Hayward tweets, "People of Cambridge, I have just consumed the first experimental trials of Andrew Northrop's own salt beef. At 0800 tomorrow, we must form a mob, armed with pitchforks and flaming brands, and besiege the Mill Road shop until he consents to make more." Well, he has made more. So on Wednesday, I dropped in on butcher Martin Young at the Mill Road branch to talk to him about it. Before fridges and chillers, there was salt and brine. But this is about salt. Salt is a natural preservative, and salt beef is a tradition that was served on the Royal Navy and merchant ships from the time of the Mary Rose up to the Second World War. Large granules of salt were known as corns, and that's why sometimes salt beef is referred to as corn beef. And salt beef is also a natural product here at Andrew Northrop Butcher's on Mill Road. And I'm speaking to Martin. Hello, Martin.
Hello there.
Martin, I came here specifically to talk to you about salt beef. My colleague Alan mentioned it was something that you were trialling here. What triggered this move?
I had to do a course in MVQ butchery. For that we needed to make bacon. I discovered how simple it was to produce that, and then I've developed a bit of an obsession with trying to make a variety of products from corned beef, pancetta and obviously the other bacon where it all started from.
And have your customers become attracted to it? Is it something they spot, or do you mention it in passing to them?
It's something at the moment I promote. We're looking next weekend, which is the 2nd of February, looking to do a tasting on the pancetta and the corned beef that we produce. So it is at this moment in time, it's something that very much I'm trying to push. That said, the couple of the things that we do are already proving reasonably popular, and trying to roll those out to some of the local coffee houses and so on to take it on.
All right, so it's not just here that it's being sold?
At this moment in time, it is just here, but I'm looking to try and push it.
Because according to an article I was checking out in the Mail Online, there used to be salt beef bars in London and New York, and today salt beef is probably associated with those large New York style deli sandwiches that come with like mustard and gherkin and with the various different breads. There's one still at Selfridges apparently called the Brass Rail Bar. Maybe one of our listeners have tried it there. Is this the kind of idea that you're thinking of with promoting the salt beef to the cafes and so on?
Yeah, along the sort of, as you say, New York deli style kind of pastrami based sort of thing is what these people will be looking for.
What exactly is this salting process, and how long does it take?
It can be done in two forms, either as a wet form, so we dissolve salt into water, that being the brine. That would take, depending on the weight or size of the piece, somewhere between 7 to 10 days. There is also dry salting, which is just rubbing or encasing the piece of meat in a salt, and that is a fairly fast process. That will be sort of 5 days we would look at doing something like that. What I do here is a brine, because I have other flavours that I want to add to the joint rather than it just being a pure straight salt beef.
I was wondering whether you add in any aromatics to the beef, anything like that?
So we use cloves, cinnamon, garlic, cumin, coriander, black peppercorns, black mustard seeds. They're all toasted and added into the brine.
Sounds a silly question for me to say this, but I guess, do you get a lot more flavour through including it at the stage of the salting like you do? It's not like a customer could expect to achieve the same results if they were to add the aromatics themselves after purchasing the salted beef.
I do the whole process. I don't buy in the salt beef and then add ingredients to it. I take the raw product. In this case, we use brisket, and I cure the whole thing. So it's not a salted beef that I buy in. I just buy in a brisket and make the cure up.
In the sources that I've been checking, they've also mentioned always brisket. Is there any other cut of beef that you would use for salting?
Silverside is a beef that can be used to produce pastrami. Quite often when you buy in a supermarket pastrami, that will be silverside. It will have the black peppercorns rolled around the outside of it. Mm. Although that works, I prefer at the moment the more traditional use of brisket because of the fat. It's also got a bit of fat content to it.
The fat is flavour.
And fat is flavour at the end of the day, yeah. So I would go with that.
Do you give cooking ideas to your customers? Do they come in asking what they can do with the various cuts that you provide?
It is the bit that makes my job interesting for me. To be able to sell the idea sells the product.
Yeah.
And so buy the dream, sell the idea to somebody. So yes, I'm a very avid cook and I love the idea of that. It's more fun for me. I mean, I enjoy my work, whatever, but it's a more fun process to try and work out what somebody may like for tea and help them with recipe ideas, point them in the direction of those.
What do you do yourself with the salted beef?
So initially I would do it as boiled beef and carrots because the beef has to be cooked one way or the other. So I would take the first serving with that and serve that with a sort of very creamy mashed potato. And if there is anything left over, then I would slice that and use that in a New York deli style sandwich with gherkins and pickles afterwards for lunch a couple of days later.
Do you reckon salt beef is gaining popularity due to, say, I don't know, a resurgence in traditional British cooking? I think before, Andrew Northrup was telling me, like, you see patterns where there maybe a celebrity chef will do a certain cut of something one week and it will just spark a surge in demand that particular week, people coming in wanting to do the same.
It certainly is the case that TV chefs are good for generating interest in selling various products. But in terms of the salt beef, I'm not really sure at the moment. It is something that some people come and ask for from time to time, but it is, again, it's something that I would be looking at doing, and just why I want to push it to make it more popular, just because it's a passion of mine now.
Okay, Martin, thanks very much. And you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
Thank you very much.
That salt beef, in Tim Hayward's words, is utterly bloody sublime. Interestingly, the following day, the Gog Magog Farm Shop, they were tweeting about making a posh salt beef potato hash. And, well, Martin's obsession is well-timed, I think, and that is a glowing review of your salt beef, available now from Andrew Northrup's on Mill Road.
The Cambridge Twitterati, whose ranks have been recently swelled by us here at Flavour, and more about that in a bit, cannot fail to have noticed that in March there is a festival of food called Eat Cambridge. I met one of the organisers, Caroline Biggs, in Fitzbillies on what I mistakenly thought would be a quiet Monday morning to find out all about it. Caroline, what's Eat Cambridge all about?
Well, the strap line for Eat Cambridge is Discover Your Pantry, and that's exactly what this is about. It's about local people finding out about independent food and drink producers in Cambridge and celebrating what they do.
And when is it? Where is it?
It's a week-long festival. It's the 8th to the 15th of March. The main event is going to be at the Guildhall in Cambridge on Saturday the 9th of May, 10:30 to 4. We're going to have over 30 stalls in the main, or two halls in the Guildhall. It's full of local producers, and there'll be some talks from some local celebrities, and yes, it'll be a really exciting day.
Right. Are you in a position to reveal who the local celebrities might be, yes, or is that something you're going to announce later?
We're going to announce these things later. We've got to get people interested and keep them guessing.
Right, okay. And what will happen in the Guildhall? I mean, you've obviously just talked about talks, but there'll be people with stalls, they'll be, selling produce, having tastings, talking to customers.
Yes, there'll be tastings, you'll be able to buy things. The most exciting thing about the Guildhall event is we're actually going to have a secret supper club happening somewhere very exciting in the Guildhall. It will not be revealed till nearer the time. And they're going to run a brunch club and then an afternoon tea.
Are many people signed up for it? Many producers signed up for it?
We've got over 30 people signed up for the Guildhall event, and sadly we've had to turn people away because they can only accommodate a certain number in the Guildhall. In addition to the Guildhall, then we have about 15 fringe events taking place all around Cambridge. And we realised quite quickly that some people who had shops wouldn't be able to come to have a stall at the Guildhall. So we thought, right, we'll take it out to them. So there's going to be some pop-up restaurants. Duke House Boutique Hotel are going to host a tea tasting with Kanjula Teas and Afternoon Teas making the cakes. And Miss Soufflé, Cambridge's Queen of the Bakers, is going to be running an event at Hotel Divan called Dine with Downton. And it's going to be a three-course meal. And William Hanson, who is the etiquette guru, is actually going to take people through how they should behave at a formal meal, downtown style.
And pop-up restaurants we don't know where they're going to be yet or who's running them?
No, of course. Some of them are secret, but obviously we'll know nearer the time. Because only small numbers are going to be accommodated, so we can't announce it too soon. We're worried to get sold out too quickly.
Right, so how will people find out? What's the medium going to be?
Keep an eye on our website. Eat Cambridge 2013 was what you need to Google. So keep an eye, come February, just keep an eye on our website if you want more information. We are going to be producing a programme that will be out mid-February, and that will be distributed around Cambridge in various places.
Well, cafes,
like Urban Larder,
so
perhaps on the market. Square. Again, we have to confirm this, so please do keep an eye on our website and Twitter.
And we will mention it on Flavour as well.
Thank
so
you.
If you let us know early on, we'll do what you can. When you talk about this, it sort of brings home, really, how vibrant the Cambridge food scene is. Do you think it's developed in that way recently?
I think it's changed hugely in the past few years. It's not to say there didn't used to be some good food producers in Cambridge. I think what has changed really now is several things. I think social media really has played quite a part, actually, in communicating to a wider range of people what's available locally. And also what's been really, really exciting is the collaboration between various food producers, such as Carrie Pavitt is a shining example of how she's worked with Burwash Manor Farms and with Moonshine Brewery and to produce some real locally sourced pies, which are absolutely delicious.
Yes, they are. And Carrie Pavitt is one of the people, isn't she, who's at Eat Cambridge?
She is.
Can you give us some indication? I know you can't go through the whole list, since there's over 30 of them, but what sort of range of people are there?
It's a really lovely range. We've actually got two Michelin star chefs, so I'm sure people will be able to guess.
Yes.
We have Tim Hayward, of course, from Fitzbillies, and Ben Pope from the Punter. But also we've got smaller people like the Biscuit Jar, Velvet Bakehouse, Limoncello, Urban Larder, Gogwogog Farm Shop. And the list is very long. I'm sorry I can't mention everybody, but please, again, go to our website and you'll see the list.
And how do you see the Cambridge food scene developing further? Have you got a vision for how you'd like it to be, or have you been to other cities and seen things there that you'd dearly like to see more of in Cambridge, perhaps?
Well, I'm a great lover of the Alborough Food Festival, which really was a catalyst for the idea of organising Eat Cambridge. But that's a week-long event too, and most other major cities seem to have a food festival, so we would like to have an annual food festival celebrating Cambridge food. But also, we want to encourage as Eat Cambridge, more collaboration really, and also to have some events where locals can actually get together, meet each other and chat, because there isn't really a forum for that happening in Cambridge at the moment. That's something we'd like to do once the festival is over. Cambridge won't die, won't end once the festival is over. There are other things we want to do. We've been approached by some really interesting people with some interesting ideas.
Right.
And we will definitely be doing some other things.
Yes, and of course just through the event, naturally, because relationships will have been forged and established, that presumably will lead to a life of its own as well.
I think so. I mean, the whole thing really has taken on a life of its own, as you say. We started, I think, we'd have a one-day event at the Guild Hall, and quite quickly we were overwhelmed with requests for that. Then we stretched it out to this one-week festival with Fringe Events, but even now it's actually stretching into 2 weeks. We actually now have a lid on it now, because we just can't manage all the requests we've had.
And is there any part for street food in this?
The street food fringe event we are running is going to be so wonderful. We've managed to secure Hope Street Yard off Mill Road, and we're going to have six vans there, retro style vans selling street food, and we're going to have some children's entertainment. We're going to have buskers. It's going to be a really exciting evening. It's going to happen on the 14th, Friday Friday the 14th of March in the evening, so it's nice and dark. We've got lots of lovely lights lighting it up, and it's going to be a really lovely event.
Wow, it gets more and more impressive as we go on. What do you think about street food in Cambridge? It's not a particularly well-developed aspect of Cambridge food life, is it?
No, there are a few vans around, but I think they struggle really, because there probably isn't enough. We probably need to be in the city centre to really get enough trade to sustain your business. And I think so that's something, yeah, it's something that some e-Cambridge can help promote, who the good vans are and where they're stationed.
Yes, and have you any contact with the city council over whether they would welcome more street food in Cambridge, or is that an unknown quantity?
Oh, that kind of thing is a county council and a city council thing, and all a bit of nightmare paperwork wise. So I think that's something we're going to look to develop in the future. There is a possibility that we might run something at Christmas as part of the big light switch on, but again, that's to be developed.
Is anybody supporting you in the event? Have you got sponsors?
We're really lucky to have some really good sponsors on board. We've got the Gogglebug Farm Shop, the Urban Larder in Mill Road, Cambridge Edition, they're our media partner. Independent Cambridge are helping us out with design, following on from their fantastic Cambridge Independent book recently published, and Cambridge Food and Wine Society. Also, we are actually supporting Food Cycle, our chosen charity for the event. The Food Cycle do fantastic work. They go to supermarkets and take away food that's still just about in date but not able to be sold, and they cook wonderful meals. And they're every Saturday at the centre at St Paul's, and anyone can just turn up to help. They're always in need of volunteers, or if anyone knows someone who might enjoy a good square meal, then I'd recommend they go there on a Saturday morning, right, 12:30.
Right, thanks very much.
And that was Caroline Biggs. And we'll be reporting again on the festival, probably in our next programme. And in case you missed the details, the festival runs from the 8th to the 15th of March, and the event in the Guildhall is on Saturday the 9th of March from 10:30 till 4. Caroline also mentioned Food Cycle and the work they do. That takes place at St Paul's in Hills Road from 12:30 every Saturday afternoon. And it sounds like they would welcome more volunteers.
Thank you, Alan. You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105. You can find out immediately about Cambridge food news by following us on Twitter at Flavour105. So why not sign up now? Now, no amount of snow coming down thick and fast is going to stop me attending this year's Seedy Sunday, a seed-swapping event at Trumpington Village Hall. It's a very interesting proposition. Just picture the scene, tables lined up and down a hall, filled with donated seed packets of all varieties, as well as product from private sellers, like the Heritage Seed Library, allowing you to buy preserved seed varieties that you cannot get anywhere else. Seedy Sunday is a national event. It's about making people aware of biodiversity and sustainability. Rather like kind of Tom and Barbara in The Good Life. But it incorporates other projects too, like Cambake, Cambridge's community bread making project established last March. Cambake were there and they were offering some of their delicious seed-inspired breads, and also present with the Trumpington Allotment Society, as well as speakers and films. Quite a lot to pack into a brief few hours of the event's running time. At last year's Seedy Sunday, I found out about Grow Zones, a national initiative using community spirit to transform your garden. One of the talks this year was by a Grow Zones exponent, and I caught up with her immediately afterward.
I'm talking now with Pippa Vine. Pippa has just given us a presentation on Grow Zones and permaculture design. Pippa, you joined the Grow Zones initiative in 2010, and you basically redesigned your garden in that year?
Yes, that was the beginning. I'd done an introduction to permaculture course the year before, and then I heard about Grow Zones, and it was the perfect way to do what I wanted to do, which was turn my garden over to growing more vegetables. I had lots of fruit, but I wanted to grow more vegetables, and I needed more structure to get myself going.
You've brought in this very intricate map of the garden that you have here. It shows me such forethought and preparation, which I think is one of the things that really came through in your presentation today. You've maximized areas of where you know that the sun is going to hit, so where to plant particular fruits and veg, I presume.
Yes, that's a very important part of permaculture. In fact, it's preferable not to just leap in. It's preferable if you can spend a year observing all the things you've just been describing, things like frost pockets and where the wind and sun are, and deciding exactly what you want to do before you get started. And that's what we did. We had the first Grow Zones session outside Bristol in my garden in May 2010. We built various raised beds in various places in my garden, and what I've been describing today is everything that's happened since then.
Mm. Now, you've brought in two rather fantastic examples that I'd like to refer to here. One of them, if we can describe this now, it looks like a cross between an upside-down UFO with holding some bizarre eggs in the top. Now, what's the name of this again?
It's a Turk's turban squash, and I didn't actually grow this one because I had a problem with my harvest this year. I brought this in as an example of one that I'd found actually in Arjuna. I just think it's very beautiful, and one day I'll eat it. The other one that you can see on the table is a spaghetti squash that I did grow the previous year.
Oh, yes.
I think squashes are a brilliant way to grow and store food because they keep for, I think, up to about 18 months. As I say, that's from the previous year. Part of what I also described was the way that we built a lean-to storage and work area out of found materials. That's another part of permaculture. You use what you've got. You have a need, and you look around to see what you've got, and you create what you need from it. And I find that a very fulfilling part of the whole process.
One thing I would really like to underline is the sheer variety of different fruit and veg that you have going on in your garden. It's quite extraordinary. Could we just mention a few here for the listener as well, just to give you a sense of, well, the wonder of it, I suppose.
Well, I've got something like 17 varieties of fruit and at least a dozen trees. So I've got 6 apple trees, a pear, 3 or 4 greengage trees, 2 other kinds of plum, blueberries in a sunken bath in the lawn, and blackberries growing against the fence. Oh, a cherry, a morello cherry tree I planted a couple of years ago.
Oh, yes.
Then I've got a heart-shaped herb bed, and then what's called keyhole beds. So if you imagine instead of a straight line, there's a channel cut into the middle so that you can get into the middle of the bed. Because one of the most important things about permaculture is that you don't walk on the soil. Once you've prepared it, you nurture it. It's a living system, and you don't walk on it to compact it. So it's really important that you can reach everything without walking on the soil.
Yeah, these are more than just pretty shapes.
Absolutely. I mean, for me, they're attractive, graceful, rounded shapes because that's what I like. Some people prefer just to have oblong raised beds built with planks, but this was my preference. And we made them with log roll edging, and in the case of a couple of later beds, with inverted wine bottles to create the edge, because ideally you want a flat surface. You don't want a sloping surface that the water will run off. So if you can create an edge so you can build up the soil and then you add to it, you add compost and natural materials. You may, for instance, put a sheet mulch over, as I did under the apple tree. We built a raised bed around the apple tree, and then I put a mulch of shredded paper and then cardboard and chipped up bark and planted strawberries through all that and some fruit canes as well. So I have 3 layers in one space.
Lovely. Well, thanks very much, Pippa. I guess, do you still keep in touch with everybody who has helped contribute to creating this garden with you?
Well, lots of them. Yes, certainly not all, because people move on. But a number of the people who took part in the Grow Zone session were members of Transition Cambridge Food Group. And that's a very lively ongoing group that meets every 2 weeks. And the ongoing Grow Zones project is supported by Transition Cambridge, although not everyone's a member. Anyone can get involved that has a growing space that they would like some help to take forward and grow more fruit and vegetables.
Lovely. Thank you very much, Pippa Vine, for your time.
You're welcome.
Look before you leap was Pippa's advice. Good advice too. I wish you could have seen the layout of her garden. It was exceptionally beautiful and diverse, all done with the principles of permaculture, using what you've got. And of course, the fun and friendship formed from working together as a team, with a great garden and great fruit and veg at the end of it. If you'd like to know more about Grow Zones, well, now is the perfect time, for you can attend the Transition Cambridge Food Group's spring launch event. And here is event organiser Jacqueline Ogden to tell us more. Okay, I'm here with Jacqueline Ogden, the facilitator for Grow Zones in Cambridge.
Hello, hello.
Would you like to give us just a little bit of detail about what you told us in this presentation just now?
Grow Zones was an idea that I came across last year. I went along to a meeting at the Friends Meeting House, and the Grow Zones team that was formed was able to come along and dig over my allotment, which was brilliant. It was a really good start, like having Brown Force come along. So we're going to do it again this year. I'm going to facilitate. Anybody who's interested can find out some more from the Transition website or come along to the meeting on the 28th of February at the Friends Meeting House.
And what's the exact address of that Transition website?
It's transitioncambridge.org. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, there's more information on there about Grow Zones. And what we did, and I expect the sort of thing we'll be doing again, although it depends entirely on what it is you want to do, we did a lot of digging over, planted potatoes, we sowed seeds, we made raised beds, all those kind of things, weeding. Mm. You can dig ponds, you can work on people's trees, pruning and so on. It's great because of the friendships that you make with people, the sense of community, the sense that you're really learning something about growing vegetables, growing your own food, and you're helping other people. So it's a really feel-good thing to be doing. It doesn't take up an awful lot of time. It's one Saturday morning every other week, generally speaking, and great idea. If you're interested, come along.
Lovely. Thank you very much, Jacqueline.
So that's Thursday the 28th of February at the Friends Meeting House in Jesus Lane. As Jacqueline said, you can check out the Transition Cambridge website to find out about this project and many more by just going to your web browser and simply typing in transitioncambridge.org/thewiki/ttwiki/pmwiki.php?nttfood.homepage. I'm joking, of course, but I use this joke as a vehicle to highlight the fact that you can leap straight to their page from our own Flavour podcast page. And you'll be able to do this as well from Flavour's new Facebook and blog pages, designed to accompany supplemental information to our programmes. Now, incidentally, our station technical director, Axel, is a great proponent of permaculture and community spirit, being involved in Transition's crop share and garden share projects. And as Flavour, we like to cover other activities of theirs too, such as Canbake and the new Sustainable Souk. It's an initiative with the catchy tagline, a geo-localized distributed market made by the people for the people. I'll hopefully be catching up with Souk organizer Mikhail in the near future. He's a very good guy, speaks about 1,000 miles an hour, maybe like me, but mad hair. And there are other community groups at Seedy Sunday too, just to reiterate that the event is more than just seeds, as this rather breathless last interview will say. From the end of the day, here we go. Everyone's packing up here now. I've just bumped into Susan Colasso, yes?
Susanna Colasso,
sorry. You just caught my eye there because you were talking about selling apple juice here.
Yes, I'm a member of the community orchard in Chumpington, and we come to the seed shop every year and sell a few bottles of apple juice so that we can keep the orchard going. So we're sort of one in spirit with the seed shop because plants are important to everyone, really, aren't they? And
yes.
All of our food sources are important.
And this is the Chumpington Orchard, did you say?
The Chumpington Community Orchard, yes.
Okay.
We planted 5 years ago in 2008, and it's planted up with the heritage trees from Cambridgeshire. So they're locally important trees. For example, Chibbers Delight from Chibbers, where they used to grow a lot of apples and produce jams and things like that. So local people will have been involved with these varieties, basically.
Okay. The Chumpington Community Orchard is a organisation, a personality in and of itself, yes? Is it? It's separate to Transition.
It is. We're a local community group that planted the orchard in 2008 with funding from the Breathing Spaces Big Lottery money and from Cambridge City Council. And the idea of the orchard is to promote local food production but also to educate people about biodiversity, because
yeah,
we've got a little meadow underneath the apple trees to encourage butterflies and all sorts of different insects. And we're enclosed by a native hedgerow to give food for the birds and small mammals and invertebrates. So we've got all sorts of things there.
Lovely. And of course producing the apple juice.
Well, not yet. Oh. That's the future. The apple juice, I'm afraid, comes from Cam Valley Orchard, just a few miles down the road. But that's a fundraiser. So that, because we have no funding, we're entirely run by volunteers and any funds that we raise from events like this.
Good, yeah. So, it was nice to meet you and nice to give a little flavour of the variety of things that are on offer here on Seedy Sunday.
It's fantastic. Seedy Sunday is becoming really, really lovely. So well done to Kerry Galloway for organising it all, is all I can say. Who is also a founder member of the Community Orchard as well.
Lovely. Nice to speak to you, Susanna.
Nice to speak to you. Safe journey home.
Thank you. And you can find out more about Chumpington Community Orchard at chumpingtonorchard.org. There's more than 2,000 varieties of apple, and the Chivers Delight that Susanna mentioned is grown by the local Chivers family for their jam factory in Histon. The Delight has been described by Monty Don as having a small orange twang of hard-edged sweetness with a waxy skin. I'd imagine the Chumpington Orchard will be looking to have an apple variety of its own one day and produce an authentic Chumpington apple juice to sell at a future Seedy Sunday. And I'll be there, reporting for Flavour on Cambridge 105.
There's all sorts of exciting things going on at the moment, and here's a brief roundup. Inda's Kitchen has teamed up with the Alexander Arms in Gwydir Street. The idea is you go into the pub on a Sunday night and order a curry from Inda's Kitchen from the pub. The pub then take care of the delivery and puts it on a plate for you. All you have to do is eat it and pay for it. There are two or three times you can order between 5 and 9pm. There were some difficulties last week because the weather made deliveries tricky, but the roads are obviously a lot better now.
A new restaurant is opening in Bennett Street called Cow, spelled C-A-U. It specialises in Argentinian beef, so look out for some really good steaks. It's the second branch to open. There's also one in Guildford, and it is part of the chain that runs the Gaucho restaurants. They're looking to open quite a few branches of Cow, mostly in the south of England.
Also in Bennett Street, a new Sicilian-style Italian cafe is opening in late February or early March, called Cafe Aromi. It too has a sister establishment, but it's in Sicily and has been there for 50 years. They're spending a fair bit on doing it up, with the aim of creating a rustic-style family-run cafe.
Some pub news now. The Milton Brewery, which as well as brewing some very good beer and also owns the Devonshire Arms, which was judged by Camera to be the Cambridge Pub of the Year, has announced that it is taking over the Haymakers in Chesterton. Excellent news. And also set to open in King Street is a pub with its own microbrewery on the site of the Jolly Scholar. The pub is owned by the group that did such a good job of redesigning the mill in Mill Lane. And speaking of the mill, its beer festival is still running, finishing this weekend, in fact.
There's a new cafe in Castle Hill too, called Cafe Arena. It's new triple threat, cafe, patisserie and creperie. It opened a few weeks ago, open from 7:30 to 5. You can go in for an early breakfast before work and round the day off with some cake and coffee. Someone told us it was a French cafe, but when I went there I discovered it was more franglais.
There is a pop-up burger restaurant at Fitzbillies on the 13th of February. You can tweet at Steak and Honour to find out about the booking situation. And finally, Le Gros Franc is opening La Maison du Steak in Hills Road shortly. More about that on the next programme.
And now for our competition. Are you tired of the same old cheesy rom-coms and horror films at the cinema? Why not add a bit of culture with a Royal Opera House production to a cinema near you? Throughout the Royal Opera House cinema season, 9 productions are being broadcast by satellite from Covent Garden to over 200 cinemas around the country. Highlights include Placido Domingo in Nabucco, Christopher Wheeldon's imaginative new ballet at Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, and one of the best-known operas in the world, La Boheme. For details and to find your nearest participating cinema, just visit roh.org.uk/cinema. Now, if you'd like to win a pair of cinema tickets to the Royal Opera House performance of Eugene Onegin on the 20th of February, just answer the following question. Who wrote the music for the opera Eugene Onegin? Was it A, Shakespeare, B, Wagner, or C, Tchaikovsky? Once again, who wrote the music for Eugene Onegin? Shakespeare, Wagner, or Tchaikovsky? If you think you know the answer, then do drop us an email at flavour@cambridge105.fm. And best of luck.
And the closing date for that is noon on Tuesday. We spend our time on Flavour talking about what is new or about to happen as far as food is concerned. But every bit as interesting, and in some ways more so, is what Cambridge's food scene used to be like. I asked local historian Becky Proctor to tell me about the past. Becky, are there Cambridge foods that really you don't ever hear of anymore and people don't eat them anymore, or drinks for that matter?
Perhaps the first thing that springs to mind is white poppy tea. Let's hope that lots of Cambridgeshire people aren't drinking it as we speak. It was something that was taken as a remedy for the symptoms of ague. This is an old sort of Fenland disease, and I think you might have heard of the character Andrew Aguecheek in Shakespeare. But ague is a kind of a rheumatism-like sort of disease, and it was very, very prevalent in the Fens because people worked incredibly hard lives in the wet, sort of watery areas of the Fens, and basically like malaria, it was very, very common and very painful. So of course the white poppy tea was kind of like taking laudanum; it was sort of a painkiller. So it was said that lots of Fenland people, you would brew this tea up. It's very common, and perhaps maybe that's where the Fenlanders get this reputation as being slightly slow and
in their speech. And did they grow
did they grow the white poppies, or
apparently,
were they imported? Or what?
Yeah, no, apparently it's very common to see it in a kind of a country garden in the Fens. Very common.
Right. So we could still make it now, were we of a mind?
I guess so. But, I mean, this
so
is...
So it wasn't drunk for pleasure? It didn't taste good?
As far as I know, as right. I think it really was taken
just
as something
medicinal.
To help the awful pains they got, the shivers and the shakes and really bad pains in the joints. But remember, most of the people in the Fens would have been working in mud and cold. I mean, you know how chilly the Fens can get on a winter's day. So they led very hard lives.
Yeah. Oh, how grim. Right. Well, was there anything nice and local to give a bit of pleasure as far as food is concerned?
Well, I think one of the most interesting things about this area, again, sticking with that kind of sort of Fen edge village, is the Cottenham cheese, which is no longer made anymore. I think they think it died out by the 1930s, but apparently it was very famous. Cottenham was known apparently for herds of cows at the time, and they are no longer around. Apparently it's sort of a very verdant kind of countryside, and so it gave the cheese a really, really good flavour. There was a white single Cottenham cheese, and there was also a blue-veined double Cottenham that was a bit like Stilton. Cottenham cheese, you know, was quite sort of noted in the past. And I think there was a lady locally who unfortunately died just last year. I saw something on the internet about it. Then she was trying to revive it and would go to local fairs. So, you know, hopefully someone else will take up her legacy and carry on making it.
Well, I hope so. I didn't ever see that, so I'm rather sorry I've missed out. And there has recently been a Cambridge blue cheese, but in fact I was going to try and interview the cheesemaker, but it turned out they do not live in Cambridge. It's not made in Cambridge,
okay.
Despite its name. I think it was made in Nottinghamshire, but stored in St. Neots. I think probably one Cambridge-related thing that people have still heard of is Cambridge burnt cream. You can get it at the Chop House in King's Parade, for example.
That's right. And
is there a story behind that?
Well, personally, I'd never heard this story until quite recently, and I went to the sister restaurant, the St. John's Chop House, and saw Trinity Burnt Cream.
Trinity Burnt Cream.
I think they might have had it as Trinity. It might have been Cambridge. I can't remember. And I thought, really? And then asked the waiter about it, because obviously I'm always trying to gather these little Cambridge sort of fascinating facts. And he sort of told me this link with Trinity, and I always go back to my Bible, which is Enid Porter's Cambridgeshire Customs and Folklore, a book that the curator of the Folk Museum in the 60s wrote. And there it was, something I'd never noticed all the times I dipped into that book and never noticed it. But there's obviously some connection with Cambridge colleges, and I think Trinity and Corpus Christi apparently had their own version of what we would now call creme brulee or burnt cream. And of course, if you Google it, it brings up more mystery and debate, because they still can't decide whether it's an English dessert or indeed a French dessert, or whether Cambridge does have any claim to inventing it.
Well, what I've read, for what it's worth, is that the Cambridge or the Trinity burnt cream, I think, has a thicker crust than the creme brulee does, and that's because there's more sugar in the crust, because what lies underneath apparently isn't sweetened. The sweetness is in the crust, and I think the Cambridge version is less sweetened still. So
that's interesting, because I had to order it when I went to the St. John's Chop House, and it's right, actually, the as you say, the base is quite sort of...
unsweet.
Well, I was going to say unsweet. I was trying to think of the right word. It's sort of... But it's fascinating, and it really links to the, as I said, the Cambridge colleges, and just reminding us how that, of course, you know, 100, 200 years ago, that's where, really, a lot of our food connections come from, because the colleges all had marvellous cooks cooking for them. And, you know, the undergrads ate relatively well for their time, and you had these wonderful cooks cooking up recipes which they became famous for, and in time the colleges, you know, that would become a famed recipe. And of course then all the undergraduates go away and they take their sort of favourite college recipes with them, so they think that's one reason why you'll find there's lots of recipes and things called Oxford or Cambridge, because of this you know, these connections with their alma mater.
So it's the university that has brought certainly some recipes to the attention of the local people.
I think that the university, because of course most people in Cambridge were very poor, it was a very small market town, so you know, most people are not dining out or eating you know, in their homes, sort of very, you know, exotic food.
Yes, well, they're probably spaced out with their white poppy tea anyway. Right, any other foods with a Cambridge connection?
Well, one of my favourites is the yard of butter. I didn't bring it along today to show you, but there's a wonderful picture of a yard of butter salesman in an old book from the 70s, and you can find copies of this picture at the Cambridgeshire Collection, which is in the Central Library. And there's a chap crouching down, bowler hatted with a little suit, with a very long wicker basket, and there he's holding this yard of butter. And what it was a pound of butter rolled out into a long sort of roll, about an inch thick, and the idea is that you could then cut small pieces very, very easily, and this could be sold to the undergraduates. So again, one of those college connections. Because, you know, 100 years ago and earlier, students, undergraduates, didn't eat in college all the time. They didn't live in college necessarily in the way we think of them.
Mm.
And you would often buy your food locally. And so the idea was he could just go and buy small amounts of butter. In a way that if you go to a B&B, you just get a tiny little slither of butter, don't you, to go with your toast in the morning. And that, if you, I think that's kind of the idea, if you imagine, a very small amount. Because people weren't able to keep things, of course, cold for very long,
yeah.
Especially the undergrads in the room.
I've heard somewhere about a Cambridge sausage.
Cambridge sausage, yes. I've got the recipe here.
Oh, right.
shall I read it out?
Yep.
If I can...
And we'll probably put it on our website as well, actually. But yeah, tell us how you make it.
Again, as I said, Cambridge and Oxford became known for certain foods, and certainly Cambridge and Oxford sausages were noted. We have this particular recipe, again, written in the wonderful Enid Porter's the book, and it's from 1869. And she copied it from an edition of Warne's Model Cookery and Housekeeping Book. 1/4 pound of beef, 1/4 pound of veal, 1/2 pound of pork, and 1/2 pound of bacon. Add to that pepper, salt, sweet herbs, and sage leaves. And after pounding, this is all inserted into skins. Very important part about a Cambridge sausage is that the editor of this particular cookery book thought they were best for breakfast. Again, Enid quotes someone saying that he thought what distinguished Cambridge sausages were sage, and that that's what made that particular to the area, but I'm sure other sausages around.
Yeah, but you don't see sage. Cambridge sausages now, at least I certainly don't. So I wonder why that stopped. And it's interesting that they used to obviously have veal in.
Yeah.
And some quantity as well.
And I think that, yeah, it's a real mix, but I wonder whether it's quite common just to sort of put in other things depending on what you have spare, really.
Yeah. But I would have thought to eat that, to have that, you presumably would be moneyed. That doesn't look like a cheap meal to me.
No, and I think the fact that, of course, it's 1869, a cookery book, the vast majority of people in 1869 are not going to be cooking to recipe books. Certainly not bought ones. Most things are kind of handed down, and the vast majority of people didn't have the money for that. I always say that if you think about a good sort of scouse, a good sort of stew, mainly based on vegetables, that's probably what a lot of people ate. One of the reasons is they didn't have the money to buy lots of meat, so lots of stews just be really flavoured with maybe a little bit of bacon, lardons. Some people perhaps maybe just bought some lard. And, you know, dripping, that would give you the flavour of the meat without actually having meat. So it's very much a vegetable-based. And the other factor is they didn't even have the tools to cook. If you can't do lots of different separate dishes. You just have to have really one pot cooking. And you just got an open fire, and it's very, very difficult to cook on an open fire. So one big old cauldron or pot.
Yes.
Much easier to suspend, and that might keep bubbling away all day.
What about sort of festivals? Were there any particular foods for festivals?
The only thing that really springs to mind is something, I know my father's mentioned it, hot peas. And I've seen a photograph, I think sort of probably around sort of wartime, 1940s, and it shows a photograph of Midsummer Fair, you know, the June Fair on Midsummer Common, and there's a hot peas stall. Now, again, I wonder whether this might be the only Cambridge delicacy. I don't know if any of your listeners have heard of... you know, hot peas or had hot peas themselves when they were kids. It's very cheap. It's certainly, again, you can imagine these are the kind of things that would be grown sort of locally.
Well, I've never heard of that.
It's probably like mushy peas. But as I said, my father certainly remembers you'd buy them in like a little sort of cone from a stall.
Yeah.
And he thinks they also had sort of a stall on the market, a hot peas stall. I know that, you know, a lot of people who worked on the land, you know, they're not going to be having some massive hamper of food at sort of in the middle of the day. Bread and an onion was very, very common. Again, cheese, like meat, would have been something that you had, you know, in small amounts and not every day. Whereas onions, again, something that could be grown locally, lots of onions. Onion tart, I know, is a bit of a delicacy around here.
Do any of these strike you as being ones that could be revived, or do you think they're all really of a more poverty-stricken
probably
age?
Probably a more poverty-stricken age.
Although we seem to be entering a new poverty, a new age of poverty, so who knows, some of these might be revived.
I mean, I don't know whether hot peas will catch on. I like mushy peas, but I don't know. But I certainly think, you know, Cambridge is a very poor county, relatively. It would be great if we could collect more information about what people remember. I mean,
and what's Good Friday bread, which I've come across somewhere as well?
Well, Good Friday bread is, again, Cambridgeshire, very remote county. Lots of superstitions persisted, and Good Friday bread was a custom. It was said that bread baked on Good Friday wouldn't go off, and it was something that was lucky. So you might keep a loaf or a sort of a hot cross bun, something like that, and keep it for a year, and that would bring good luck to the family. But I've also heard of it being used to as a sort of a cure. So if anybody got a stomach complaint, diarrhoea, you could grate a little bit of your hot cross bun or something like that into like a warm milk, and that was supposed to settle your stomach. So I don't know if there's some kind of, I don't know, mould or sort of some kind of almost like penicillin
going on there. Aged.
But again, I used to work at the Folk Museum, and they still have on display there a lovely little cottage loaf which was baked in 1919, and that has no mould on it. It's very hard, but
amazing.
That's from the village of West Ratting, I believe. So, again, something else that I think that was probably collected in the time of Enid Porter when she was curator there.
Yeah.
And she was a great one for trying to find these local customs and traditions.
So you'd be interested if any of our listeners
Absolutely.
Have any memories either from their past or their parents or even grandparents' past they might like to share with us. And thanks to Becky Proctor for that. If you do have any memories of foods or food customs that used to happen in Cambridge, do let us know and we can pass them on to Becky. You can email us at flavour@cambridge105.fm or tweet us at flavour105. We'll hear some more from Becky next time when she talks about long-disappeared Cambridge food shops. But let's move from food history to food futures. I spoke with Clara Paul of the excellent Books for Cooks bookshop in Notting Hill about current food trends in London.
Yeah, street food I think is a major trend at the moment, and there are lots of places opening up that are type specific. So there's a place called Bubble Dogs, which is just hot dogs with a multitude of toppings and fries, but they also serve champagne with it, hence the Bubble Dog, which... is that a good combination? I'm not sure. I tried to go, but by the time, you know, I got there and it was a 5-hour wait or something, which I was not prepared to do.
And is this an establishment, a permanent spot?
Yeah. It's in Soho in London.
Yeah. And what sort of toppings are there? Did you get close enough to find out?
Yeah, I mean, I've looked online. Chili dogs, which are a big thing, which is where you have chili on top, or melted cheese, or guacamole, like in a Mexican-style hot dog, or, the All-American classic with onions and jalapeno and stuff.
Yeah.
Then there's one that's lobster burger, which is either you have a lobster roll or a burger.
So, I've got a friend who's been to wherever that is.
And the Honest Burger. There's STK, which is a new steak place. So I think the trend seems to be to go to somewhere and just have the choice of one thing, and I think people are a fan of not choosing, or you go somewhere and you feel like you're going to have the best hot dog of your life. But the question is, can these people give you the best hot dog of your life?
Yeah.
Which I think is interesting. And a lot of these food trends are very much American based. So hot dogs aren't a part of British food culture. So I'm a believer that you'll only get your best hot dog somewhere in America, because that's where it is at its best. And I think there are lots of southern kind of barbecue style places, some of which are really good. Pick Q is one that I'm a huge fan of, and they started with a street van, and they're really great and they know what they're doing. But I've been to other places where I wasn't so kind of enamoured by the whole experience.
Right. So these places will do sort of traditional, if that's the right word, traditional street food.
I suppose typical.
Often will enliven them in some way, the different toppings for
hot dogs. Different, and you have a glass of champagne with your hot dog. The Mexican thing was massive, I'd say 4 to 5 months ago, 6 months ago. And that's perhaps waning now, it seems, as this kind of American style street food is really growing. There was the Venetian tapas cicchetti thing that was massive with the Polpo group of restaurants. Their book is out and has sold very well.
Yes, so, I saw it on your table, actually. Yeah.
It's interesting to see. How do you anticipate what will be next? That's the question. And also...
And who does anticipate it? Is it the same people or the leaders that move from one thing to another?
No, I think it's an ever-emerging group, mm-hmm. which is a great thing. You know, the market can never be saturated in theory. I think, again, the social media aspect of food is becoming ever important and a very strong presence and a strong means to get yourself out there.
Presumably Twitter.
By tweeting and Facebooking and Instagramming and using all of these tools to really expose yourself, which is a great thing, but perhaps I feel, is it a bit elitist or a bit alienating? Because if you're of a certain generation or a technophobe like me, and I'm young, I think you're perhaps not as able to access and discover all of this new stuff, or you do 4 months after everyone else and it doesn't feel so exciting.
But the best will presumably make its way into the mainstream
exactly.
at some point. So,
and you know, the restaurant reviewers now are crawling over everything to really get all the information out there, so I think that's a good thing.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with spending a soft Sunday afternoon looking at all the blogs and stuff online if that's what you want. Yeah. It's an interesting time in food, I would think.
Yeah.
And who knows what will be next. My colleague here and I would love to see dim sum soup dumplings take over the world.
Right.
You heard it here first.
Right, okay, well, we'll see what
you
happens.
You never know, yeah.
Right, thanks.
Maybe the pop-up burger restaurant at Fitzbillies is a move towards the trends that Claire has just spoken about.
Yeah, maybe it is. Right, right now we're going to look ahead to Valentine's Day, and Tom Lewis has joined us in the studio to give us some recommendations. Tom.
That's right. Hello, Alan. What is there in January? There's detoxing and breaking your New Year's resolutions. I mean, Valentine's Day is the only thing really we have this month to look forward to.
Yes, you're right. So what about a Valentine's wine?
Well, call me old-fashioned, but I think for Valentine's Day the wine should be pink, fizzy or sweet, maybe even all three.
Right, so what have you got?
Well, my first wine is a fizz from Joseph Barnes in Saffron Walden. It's called the Sanford Estate S, and it's a Brut non-vintage. So what that means is it's a champagne-style sparkler from Australia that comes with a big sunny grin. It costs £11.50, and it's got some champagne character. There's yeasty brioche and biscuitiness, but it's big enough to stand up to some food.
Tom, this champagne, or champagne-style wine as we have here, is it normally a food wine, do you think?
Very much so. I think in general terms, I would pretty much say all French wines are food wines. This being from the New World, it's got a bit of extra New World ripeness, but to me, in nature, it's still an Old World style food wine. Mm. You could match it with white cheese like Brie or some light seafood.
Right, okay, so we've done fizzy. Is it pink next?
It's moving on to pink. The next two are both pinks. My first one is from Noel Young, and it's a rosé from Provence. It's clean and racy. It's the Domaine du Grand Cru for £8.95. It's a blend of four southern French grapes, and in the glass it's a salmon pink colour. It's quite spicy on the nose, and it's delicate but full-flavoured. It has a nice tangy sort of character. This would be good with light fishes or a salad. Next is back to Australia for the Innocent Bystander Pinot Noir Rosé. That's from Cambridge Wine Merchants, and it's also £8.95. Now, Jancis Robinson describes this one as chock-full of slightly smoky Pinot character with no excess sweetness or alcohol. It's also salmon pink in colour, and it has aromas of fresh apples and strawberries. It's a medium body and refreshing acidity with good length, so it's a good sipper, but it'll also match with a nice romantic dinner.
Right, so that's the pink. What's next?
Well, I've saved the best one for last. It's certainly the most exuberant. It's the Karate Rosé from Bacchanalia. It has a shocking pink fuchsia label, and the bottle is blacked out, so it's going to make quite a statement on the table, if that's the effect you're after.
Have they put all of the effort onto the bottle, or are the contents worth drinking?
Well, I think you can tell from the bottle that this is not an entirely serious wine, but then we're talking about not an entirely serious occasion. It's a pink fizz from Italy. It's got some crisp acidity with grapefruit and raspberry aromas. But there's also some interesting chopped herbs and bitter almonds in there. and I think this would work nicely as an aperitif or with the sort of light foods I've been talking about already, or maybe grilled fish or a seafood risotto. So if you are looking for that none too serious statement, this one is $10.99 and it's from Bacchanalia.
Yeah, right, okay. But you haven't mentioned a sweet wine, Tom. Is there anything good in that respect?
Well, I think sweet wines are really a whole topic in themselves, so maybe we should cover that one next time.
Yeah, okay.
Aoife Maxwell got in touch to ask me to talk about sherries, and of course that means talking about sweet sherries, so we could talk about those then.
Yeah, well, that would be good, because I think sherry is starting to become fashionable again, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not just for aunts and vicars these days.
And Cambridge Food and Wine Society is doing an appropriately Valentine's Just Desserts event in February, I think.
That's right. It's Jo Kraczynska from Afternoon Teas is doing a series of desserts, and I'm helping her to match those to some sweet wines. That's going to be on the evening of Saturday, February the 16th, at the Cambridge Food and Wine Society in central Cambridge.
Okay. How do people join in with that if they fancy it?
Well, the details are all on the Society's website. It's cambridgefoodandwinesociety.org.uk, or just search online for Cambridge Food and Wine Society.
And so those are the Valentine's wine sorted. Anything else?
Well, my final bit of advice, I think, is to get some flowers as well, and just make sure that they're not from a garage forecourt.
A mistake we've probably all made, actually.
Yes.
And not to be repeated, I can tell you. Right. Okay, well, thanks very much, Tom.
Thank you.
So next time, sherry, yeah?
Absolutely.
Brilliant. Okay. Right, shall we move on to the
newspapers?
Yes. Papers?
Yeah.
Right, okay, a truncated look at the papers today because we haven't got quite as much time as usual. And they are a bit January-ish, actually, in their main features, to be honest. Rowley Lee in the Times as a recipe for prunes, and Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall in the Guardian focuses on tinned tomatoes, you know. But more of those two in a minute. Also in the Guardian is Yotam Ottolenghi, and his book, Jerusalem, I must say I'm finding really good, simple but very tasty recipes. Have you done much from it, Ruth?
No, I haven't. I actually have, I don't have Jerusalem.
Right.
I've got Plenty, which is the vegetarian one.
Yeah, I think it's worth getting. Anyway, today he has curry roasted root vegetables with lime, using curry powder, surprisingly, and his second recipe is vine leaf and lamb pie. And I do hope the use of curry powder, which I think takes the fun out of a bit, doesn't herald a move in his recipes towards the less adventurous. Lots of us enjoy going to Al Amin to search out ingredients we've never heard of before. There's no Dan Leopard in The Guardian magazine, and that's because he's moved into the new 16-page supplement called Cook, where he has an amply illustrated double-page spread to celebrate Australia Day with macadamia ginger cake with Lamington icing. And ginger is also the subject of the main feature, which is about the 10 best ginger recipes and includes such temptations as sweet potato and ginger soup, herb and ginger fish cakes, and double ginger breakfast crumble, which I mention because it also has the stunning combination of rhubarb and ginger, and in it it uses ginger in both its fresh and crystalline forms. This heralds me going on about rhubarb for months, of course, now that it's back in the shops. There's a feature on using rhubarb for Burns Night desserts, or for a North African lamb stew too in Cook. And finally in Cook, Felicity Cloakes tests some readers' recipes that involve crumbles, sausage crumble, sweet pumpkin and apple crumble and so on. And maybe Matt should try out some of our listeners' recipes. You know, that's something you could do.
Certainly would like to, yes. I'm happy to put anything on Clueless in the Kitchen.
Yes, good. Let's get back to the Financial Times, since I've now come to terms with prunes. The recipe is for far breton, or custard cakes with prunes, and actually very good it looks too. An easy-to-follow recipe that includes a tea bag, vanilla and rum, and prunes. To be fair, he does tackle people's prune prejudices head-on, and quotes the marvellous Jane Grigson's loathing of them. However, his recipe has me as a possible convert. If I try it, I'll let you know. Elsewhere in the Financial Times magazine,
Lily O'Brien, ex-pastry chef of St. John's, has a couple of marmalade recipes and one for forced rhubarb jam. On the wine front, the Financial Times' Jancis Robinson tries some Canadian wines, and the Guardian's Francis Beckett, who, by the way, has a very good food and wine matching website, gives some specific examples of supermarket wines that cost double what they should. Her advice: use your local wine merchant. And finally, some whiskey reviews by Andrew Jefford in the Financial Times. So if you're looking for a whiskey that has, and I quote, malt, spice, fruit and vanilla sweetness in string quartet harmony, look to the Financial Times. So that's the newspapers.
Okay, thank you, Alan, and that brings us to the end of another show. We'd like to say many thanks to all of our interviewees. So that would include Martin Young, Caroline Biggs, Pippa Vine, Jacqueline Ogden, Susanna Colasso, Becky Proctor and Clara Paul.
And do let us know of your memories of Cambridge food and food customs. You can email us at flavour@cambridge105.fm, tweet at flavour105, or if there's anything you'd like Matt to try his hand at cooking. The next live edition will be on the Saturday, the February 9th at 12 noon. And don't forget, you can find our previous episodes on our podcast page on the Cambridge 105 website. Do join us next time. Coming up next is Saturday Lunch.
Goodbye. Bye.